Hi, I'm Allison Kulo.
Hi, I'm Roger Goldman. Welcome to Mountain Money.
In April 2021, Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg said the following in an interview.
Often this wasn't just an act of neglect. Often this was a conscious choice. There is racism physically built into some of our highways. And that's why the jobs plan has dollars specifically committed to reconnect some of the communities that were divided by these dollars. So there's intention about that.
Buttigieg was ridiculed by parts of the media. The notion that a highway could be racist was absurd, some argued. But such a glib observation ignores the reality of how infrastructure in this country has impacted minority populations in dramatic and harmful ways. Where and how highways and bridges are constructed have destroyed thriving minority communities and have promoted racial separation in many instances.
Earlier this year, sweeping new infrastructure legislation was passed on a bipartisan basis. In implementing the bill, what lessons should be drawn from the racial impacts of the building of the interstate highway system in the 1950s? We're fortunate this morning to have been able to record an interview with Professor Deborah Archer of the NYU Law School, who's written about the history of racial inequity in highway construction. Good morning, and thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
You know, as we noted, the notion that highways could be racist was widely ridiculed. Let's start with an overview of why, from your perspective, that fundamentally misses the point.
Absolutely. That's an important point that I think we have glossed over since that statement was made. Transportation has always been both a reflection and a driver of inequality. America's transportation infrastructure is really a fundamental part of the racial architecture of our country, with barriers that are both visible and invisible. And transportation policy has been integral in creating and solidifying our racially segregated landscape, serving as what I call walls, wedges, and extractors in Black communities around the country. And among the most prominent of the state-sponsored racial dividers, separating white communities from Black communities and communities of opportunity from communities of exclusion, are highways, this kind of physical barrier that America built, often with the express intent of enforcing racial lines. The officials who built the interstate highway system in the 50s and 60s were often motivated explicitly by racism, looking for ways to replace traditional tools of racial segregation that were beginning to fall under the weight of legal challenges, like challenges to racial covenants and racial zoning. So the highways were used as a segregation wall to protect white people from Black migration. And the building of the highways also interacted with other racist housing policies of the time, like redlining, that devalued homes in Black communities and led to a lack of private and public investment in those communities. And then we used that as an excuse to engage in what was called slum removal, that really destroyed vibrant Black communities. I think finally, highway builders place little value on Black people, Black homes, and Black communities often. And we see that. So yes, racism is built into our physical environment, including our highway system. And highways have been integral in creating and solidifying our racially segregated and discriminatory landscape.
As I was preparing for this interview, I was reading your the research that you've done. And it's not like subtle, it's actually blatant as far as what some of these decisions did to isolate Black communities. Can you talk a little about the practices of Robert Moses and the notion that infrastructure could be used to literally, as you said, cement barriers?
Yeah, so it wasn't subtle in many cases. Folks were quite explicit, often doing this at the request of communities that said they were afraid of integration and the highways was the solution. So Robert Moses, who many people know as the influential New York public official who shaped urban development and public works projects, both in New York City, around New York State, but also around the country, because he was a leader among those who believed that infrastructure projects and physical barriers would be effective permanent or semi-permanent barriers to access for people of color. And he was a leader in pushing the idea of linking the building of inner city highways and the destruction of urban communities. and putting housing right through Black communities. He knew that highways would become the framework within which we all lived and our communities would evolve. And he recommended putting those highways right through Black communities. I also think it's important that, because he thought part of the genius in utilizing highways was that you were going to be able to cement in racial inequality and exclusion in a way that would outlast our current laws that facilitated racial exclusion and skirted our current laws and any laws that would come afterwards. And we've seen that he was in large part right.
And if you don't mind, I would love you to just give the listeners a little bit on the story of the height of bridges. Yeah. You know, again, it's not just placing the highways. There were some specific pieces.
No, he's, I think Robert Moses implemented his philosophy around segregation and exclusion in lots of ways. One example that is not transportation infrastructure, but in Harlem, in one of the parks that he built, in the fences, there are monkeys in one of the playgrounds, embedded in the fences in one of the playgrounds in Harlem, there are monkeys. And that's not true in the other parks that he built. But the example that you mentioned, he took great pains to build New York's roads and highways in a way that limited the ability of poor people of color to access the beautiful things that he was building, the parks and the beaches. So as the story goes, Moses constructed the highway in New York City, and he instructed highway engineers to build the bridges that went across the Southern State Parkway with 1 foot less clearance than the bridges on the Hutchinson, Sawmill, and Bronx River Parkways. And the clearance was intentionally too low for buses coming from New York City to pass, because he believed that people coming from New York City, Black people, Puerto Rican, New Yorkers, would more likely access the beaches and the parks by bus than by car. So as a result, bus trips to the beach would have to be made on all of these local roads around the city, making the trips really just too long and too challenging to be worth it. And interestingly, the law at that time already prohibited commercial traffic, including buses, from using all of the parkways. And when he was asked why he made the bridges low, he said that legislation could always be changed, but it's very hard to tear up a bridge once it's built. And that's a philosophy that has traveled through. It's hard to tear up a bridge once it's built. It's hard to tear up a highway once it's built. It's hard to bring back houses, businesses, and communities once they've been bulldozed to make way for the highway.
And that sort of leads us into my next question, which is, tell us a little bit about some of the neighborhoods that were actually destroyed by highway construction. In some of your research, you talked about the Overton neighborhood in Miami or the North Nashville neighborhood. Can you give us a little bit of light on how that happened?
Absolutely. I think the highway functioned in a variety of different ways. So first, the highways were a tool of removal. And in states around the country, highway construction displaced Black households and really cut the heart and soul out of thriving Black communities as homes, churches, schools, and businesses were destroyed. And in some communities, the highway became the tool that white government officials had been looking for a long time. And as you mentioned, the destruction of a Black community to make way for I-95 in Miami, Florida, is really an example of that, of the way that construction of the interstate highway system was used to actualize a racial agenda to destroy a Black community. So I-95 tore through the center of Overtown, which was at that time a large and vibrant Black community that was considered to be the center of economic and cultural life for Black people living in Miami. And the destruction of Overtown was the realization of a decades-long campaign by white business leaders to remove Black residents and to claim that land to expand Miami's central business district. They had tried other tools and they all failed. And so the highway coming through was a bit of a gift. And by the late 1960s, Overtown was dominated by the highway. And there was really no evidence of why some people had called it the Harlem of the South. At the time, there were reports that they demolished every home, church, apartment building, and business in Overtown. No corner was saved. And although nearly 40,000 Black people lived in Overtown before the highway expansion. Only about 8,000 remained after the highway was built. And then another way that the highways functioned was to destroy Black communities by dividing them up and breaking apart the sense of community, kind of tearing apart the social fabric and the social connections that allow cities to thrive. And in Nashville, I-40 was built right through the main Black business district, which had been home to 128 Black-owned businesses. And in addition to destroying most of those businesses, it destroyed churches. 50 local streets were dead-ended, inhibiting traffic and movement. So we talk about the destruction of homes, but with the destruction of businesses and the kind of cordoning off of a community, it has a deep economic impact. And so I-40 separated children from playgrounds, it separated children from their schools, separated the people who were attending churches from their churches, patients from their hospitals. And Fisk University, Meharry Medical College, and Tennessee State University, which are three historically Black colleges and universities, they were walled off from each other by the highway and also walled off from the community that the school served. So the highway physically constrained the future growth of these three institutions.
What I was reading specifically regarding the Overtown was that it had significantly removed like 90%, I guess, of all the low income housing. And so again, one thing to like people forget is that that was not necessarily replaced at the amount that was removed, and it was already at like full capacity. So they already needed to look at building more housing for that neighborhood.
That's right. They destroyed much needed housing that wasn't replaced. And people were forced to try to find housing in already overcrowded and racially segregated neighborhoods. And in that way, it also further entrenched racial segregation and inequality.
So we've talked about the concept of destroying neighborhoods, which is one thing that you write about extensively. Let's talk about the next concept, which is dividing white neighborhoods from Black neighborhoods. Give us some examples of how they use the interstate system to do that kind of physical division.
Yeah, I think in many communities around the country, the highway system spared Black homes and Black businesses, but it was a tool of a resegregationist agenda, erecting barriers and walls post Jim Crow that separated white and Black communities. And as I said before, kind of made white communities feel like they were protected from Black migration. And Atlanta is a key example there. In 1960, the Atlanta Bureau of Planning explained that the proposed route for Interstate 20 was intended to be the boundary between the white and Black communities, and it was at the request of community members. Similarly, in Orlando, Florida, Interstate 4 was built to provide a barrier separating Black residents on the west side of town from white residents in the central business district on the east side of town. And again, that was done at the request of white residents who demanded some protection from integration that they saw coming.
When I read your writing, you talk about opportunities that exist with modern highway redevelopment. And so with all of this actually cemented into the ground, how are you looking at this with a positive view, and what changes can be made?
Yeah, it's an interesting time, I think. The highways we thought would be there forever are aging, crumbling, falling apart, and presenting an opportunity. And I think the events over the past 3 years have really shifted the way that people engage with their community and see systemic inequality and infrastructure in so many forms has been a part of that conversation. So at this moment of change and opportunity, what we do to rebuild our infrastructure is going to shape our futures and our communities for decades. But weaving cities back together, rebuilding them and connecting them to other communities that they were separated from is incredibly difficult. So as we as a country and as communities engage in the project of highway redevelopment and focus on building infrastructure, racial equity, focusing on repairing racialized harms and advancing racial justice in both process and outcome, has to be central. I think the infrastructure plan certainly holds promise. It really could be transformative because it potentially represents an historic investment in urban communities and communities of color, investments in transportation and schools and all the things that are critically important factors in the ability of communities and people to live and thrive and be happy. But that goal and potential alone does not mean that it's going to advance racial equity. What is not clear is how the money will be distributed in a way that will address the racial inequalities that are built into our transportation system and our infrastructure. So the goal of racial equity needs to be accompanied by programs and approaches that are specifically focused on that. We have to address the racial inequality that is already built into our transportation system, but we also need to pay close attention to how and where funding will be used and whether any of that funding will be used to create parity and equity before moving us all forward with a plan to bring us into the modern age on our transportation system.
I want to go back into process for a second. And mm-hmm. with that, you had talked about, okay, we don't know how the distribution of funds are going to go, but how do we make sure that the process doesn't carry additional biases that we, you know, that the first process had? How do we make sure that we're doing it right this time?
And I think that that's important because we all still carry some biases. There's still explicit racial bias that we see in our communities. We're still grappling with the systemic inequality that is the architecture of our communities. And there's the forces of implicit bias. A first step is being conscious of those things and the way that they can impact all of our systems, including our transportation system and infrastructure. But beyond that, I think deep and sustained community engagement and involvement from the very beginning stages of the process to the very end. What each community needs is going to differ. Communities were impacted in different ways. And so one size fits all solution is not going to work. And we need to make sure that from beginning to end, communities are engaged as partners in a real and meaningful way. And there are some communities around the country that are trying to do that, are trying to model that type of deep community engagement.
You know, lawyers do love to talk about process. And, you know, for years now, we've approached environmental impact studies as part of any sort of major construction project. Is your thinking that something along those lines from an equity impact needs to be built into the process? Have I got that basically right?
I think that is a huge part of that. It's one way of ensuring that we are thinking about and centering racial equity. And we've done it in a limited way in the context of environmental impact statements where we were looking at the broader impact on communities. But even in that context, racial justice is not centered. So when adopted, racial equity impact studies can be a really powerful tool for understanding how past, present, and proposed systems and procedures can contribute to racial inequality and force government agencies and government actors to think about the complicated web of considerations that go into ensuring that we don't harm racial minority and minority communities.
Are you seeing indications? I know the infrastructure bill was only passed earlier this year. Are there any sort of administrative regulatory movements that look to establish anything like that? Are you seeing signs that they're going to the transportation department is going to try to implement something along these lines?
I think we've certainly seen positive signs from the Department of Transportation at the federal level, where the conversation has focused on understanding the impact that our transportation infrastructure has had and correcting that impact and moving forward in new building projects in a way that centers racial equity. I think the challenge will be just as it was in the 50s and 60s, what happens at the state and local level. I've seen some communities where state and local governments have now partnered with community members to really try to think about a way to move forward more equitably. An example is in Indianapolis, Indiana, where they are engaged in a massive highway redevelopment project and have engaged in a meaningful way all members of the community in a way that I think should be replicated. Similarly, in Syracuse, there, New York, they're engaged in meaningful conversations. But there are other parts of the country where we're seeing some of the patterns of the 50s and 60s repeated, where Black communities that are seen as having less political power, less tools to resist, are being targeted for new highway projects or highway expansion projects using some of the money that is going to come through the infrastructure project. And I see South Carolina as an example of that.
Well, I appreciate the examples of those that you're excited about, Indianapolis being one of them. I'm excited to watch and see how that progresses. We've been speaking with Professor Deborah Archer of the NYU Law School. Deborah, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you so much for having me and for advancing this kind of conversation.
Every financial decision, career, job, marriage, location, housing, investing, 401k, divorce, Social Security, matters to our bottom line, our living standard. Yet, we routinely make such decisions without knowing their living standard impacts. No wonder. They involve multiple, highly complex moving parts. There is a major opportunity to materially improve our financial lives.
Enter acclaimed economist and New York Times bestselling author, Lawrence Kotkoff, who brings us Money Magic, an economist's secrets to more money, less risk, and a better life, which is filled with powerful secrets to dramatically raise readers' living standards, secure their financial future, and improve their lifestyles. Kotkoff draws on uncompromising economics, years of research, and advanced computation to find readers, no matter their age or circumstances, far more money, safety, and happiness. Larry, thank you for joining us this morning.
Pleasure to be with you.
So let's start off with, why did you write Money Magic, and how long did it take you to write it?
Well, it took about 3 years to get the kind of right pitch and to really figure out what I wanted to exactly what I wanted to talk about. But the main reason I went into economics was to try and help society, to help individual households. I was attracted to economics for that, be able to do something useful. And what I noticed in working on research in personal finance, on this adequacy of saving, on the adequacy of life insurance, and other topics like that, is that the advice that economics was providing or should have been providing was at complete odds with what conventional finance was providing, or conventional personal financial advisors were providing, which was coming directly from Wall Street. And it seemed to me that they were gearing their advice to sell product, financial product. So I thought it was very important for economists to convey what we had to say. We've been working on this in terms of research for 100 years. And then in 1993, I started developing a software program called Maxify.com, which does full lifetime financial planning. So it delivers the economics approach of financial planning. But then I realized that not everybody was interested in running software, that it was something that only a segment of society wants to do. So I said, okay, let me take all the knowledge from economics, from finance, from all the Nobel Prize winning work, from what I've learned from running the software a zillion times for different households. Let me pull it all together and convey it in a book. And that when you reveal some of the answers, you find that it's magical to people hearing it for the first time because it's so different from what conventional knowledge has to say.
While you come from an economics background, obviously, the work really sits on something called iterative dynamic programming. Can you explain what that is and why does this provide a better outcome or advice to the consumer?
Well, a dynamic program was developed back in the 1950s by a famous mathematician, Blackwell. And it's used in engineering and actually by NASA for guiding rocket ships to the moon. It's a way of adjusting what you're going to do based on where you are, not knowing in advance where you're going to be. So you have to have a general plan for how to react in the future. Like, you know, if you're off course, how do I readjust to get to the moon? So that has to be, that's used routinely in economics. But for this particular problem that households have to solve, which is really a rocket science type problem, there are so many interconnected parts that you can't solve for everything with one dynamic program. So I developed an algorithm, a methodology, which got a patent. It's very hard to get a patent for algorithms, computational algorithms, but I got one for what's called iterative dynamic programming, where we've got three dynamic programs under the hood of Maxify Planner, two are doing sending data to the third. So the third is working with data from the other two programs, and then it does its thing, and then another of the two, three programs does its thing based on data from the other two programs. And then you take those two outputs and go to and update the third program. So it's iterative. It means constantly updating because you have chicken and egg problems. You can't figure out things like the path of taxes of a household unless you know its path of spending and vice versa. So you have to kind of guess the answer, update, run the other programs, figure out an update to the guesses, and use that back and forth until everything converges.
So there's a lot of moving parts, whether, you know, in someone's finances, and at the introduction, we were able to talk about kind of all those decisions that we make and are responsible for. But it felt like within the book, there were two things that provided structure to the advice that you were giving. One is living standards and two is consumption smoothing. Can you give us a background on these two concepts and why they are essential when looking at financial planning?
Yeah, economics is all about our welfare, and our welfare is assumed to depend on our consumption. And that's really, you know, another term for that is our living standard. Our consumption per household member is our living standard. So we're not interested in just helping people accumulate money for the sake of being Uncle Scrooge and having a swimming pool full of dollar bills. We're into trying to help people have a higher living standard, but also one that's sustainable. It doesn't make you happy to eat 100 steaks at one sitting. You want to be able to eat steaks your entire life because of physiology. You get satiated. So that's the idea of having a smooth living standard to deal with the satiation issue. You don't want to be running out when you're 95 and living on the street, but you also want your living standard to be as high as possible. And then you want to be able to make decisions based on its impact on your living standard. If I retire early, how much is that going to reduce my living standard permanently by 20%? Or is it going to be a 5% hit? Or if I get divorced, will that, you know, I kind of hate my spouse. I hate that my spouse to the tune of a 15%. I'm willing to leave my spouse if it's not going to cost me more than 15% of my living standard. But if it's going to be in a 30% drop, I'd rather stick it out with my spouse. You need to be able to price these decisions, these lifestyle decisions, in terms of your living standard. And then the other thing, last leg of personal finance, is when you're investing at risk, or to understand how your living standard evolves, how it spreads out through time. If you invest aggressively and spend aggressively, what's the upside paths that you might experience? What are the downside paths to your living standard, where you're adjusting your living standard all the time in light of your portfolio returns? So living standard is central to what economics says to look at.
I am still rattling through my brain that only an economist would look at divorce as being the what is it going to do to my consumption of living standards. But I understand exactly what you're saying. Another thing that you touch on in the book is the concept of the importance of a career choice in financial planning. You talk about how different professions might earn the same amount over their lifetimes, even though they would seem to come from very different educational backgrounds. Can you talk a little bit about the factors that should be considered when determining future employment opportunities?
Well, yeah. Again, it comes back to your living standard. If I become the first chapter is entitled "My Daughter, the Plumber." When I'm Jewish, and when I was a kid, it was always the Jewish mother saying, "My son, the doctor." Right? That was the because Jewish has always wanted their sons to be doctors for whatever reason. It goes back to the Middle Ages, that expression. So, my daughter, the plumber. Plumbers can these days can make more on a lifetime basis than PCPs, when you take into account the fact that PCP has to go to 4 years of college, 4 years of medical school, 3 years of internship and residency, earning basically nothing for 8 years, and then very little for 3 years, and then finally gets a decent salary, but then she's being treated as if she's a rich person, and therefore is being taxed at a very high marginal rate. And then there's also, you know, things like malpractice insurance. When you put it all together, plumbing is a safer, less stressful don't call me on weekends, don't call me at 3 a.m. lifestyle. And so it can beat or at least be as good as becoming a doctor. And you have to make a decision at an early age, even at 18, and not be coerced into doing something your parents or grandparents or want you to do, which is get a college education when 70% of our kids are not getting college degrees. 40% are going to college, but not graduating. I mean, 40% of the kids that do go to college don't graduate. So I have a chapter called Don't Borrow for College. I'm a college professor. It's called Don't Borrow for College. It's not cutting any, you know, corners here. It's being very direct that this is way too risky. Who borrows money for the ability to invest in something with a 40% chance of returning absolutely nothing? And we have a lot of kids doing exactly that. They borrow in order to fail out of drop out of college. So we have to look at our careers and our educational decisions with very, hard-nosed manner, very abstractly, and decide, can I get an education by going to a community college, not borrowing, but taking online certificates now that are free or very inexpensive, get the certificate, get the grade for the online course, take those courses from Harvard, Stanford, Yale, Chicago, Boston University, where I'm at, and present those to IBM. If I'm, let's say, taking 20 courses in quantum computing, and they're looking for somebody in quantum computing, and I provide 20 courses with good grades, they're going to hire me over the English major from Williams College, who's sitting on $300,000 worth of debt. He and his parents, and, you know, the kid himself can't borrow more than about $31,000, but the parent can borrow an unlimited amount and stick that borrowing onto the kid's, bill, on the kid's tab. You know, we don't know when the parent borrows on behalf of the kid whether the kid is going to be stuck with a repayment or whether it's going to come out of the kid's inheritance because the parent is not going to reduce their lifestyle. He's just going to say, hey, you know, I have less money because I spent on your college, and therefore when I die, you're going to get less. So in effect, the kid is spending all this money without knowing it.
Education is definitely one of the areas that can derail someone's finances. One of the other things that you talk about is retirement, and you say that there's a magic with regards to delayed retirement. Can you go into that a bit?
Well, if you retire later, chances are you're going to wait to take your Social Security, which has an enormous return. The benefit at age, taking a retirement benefit at 70, is 76% higher adjusted for inflation than if you take it at 62. So every year that you wait to take your retirement benefit is going to be give you about a 7-8% higher real value. So that's an enormous gain. If you wait to retire, you're likely to wait to take Social Security. You're also going to shorten the number of years that you have to pay for your retirement. Retirement can last longer than you worked these days. If you retire at 60 and you make it to 100, my mom died at 98. You have to plan to live to your maximum age of life, which might be 100, because you might live that long. So if I'm deciding to retire at 60, I'm likely to take Social Security too early at 62. And not contribute as much to my retirement account as would otherwise be the case. Therefore, I have less money from that. Also have to pay for medical insurance before I get onto Medicaid, which is at 65. So here I'm 5 years paying heavy duty medical insurance bills that I would otherwise have paid for me by my employer. So there's all these interconnected things that impact you and are bad when you retire early. So what I say is in the book is that for most Americans, retiring early is financial suicide. It's the decision to take the longest vacation of our lives. It's something we should think about five times over and calculate its impact. And the book gives some very simple algebraic tricks for doing that.
You also provided some interesting advice on housing, which is often the largest single investment for most households. You sort of say that we shouldn't consider mortgage payments as part of basic cost. What do you mean by that?
Well, mortgage is just borrowing. You know, it's connected. It's referred to as a housing cost, but it's not actually connected to housing. I could have my house fully paid off, go borrow on it via mortgage, and then use the money to do X, Y, and Z. I could go buy, I could invest the money. So the mortgage is just a loan. It's not directly connected to living in a house or any particular house that you buy. It's just borrowing money. The only reason it's connected to housing is that they put a lien on your house. They get some collateral from you that's connected to your house. But you can borrow on a mortgage in order to invest in a business. When I have this small software company on the side, this Maxify.com software company. And, you know, when I went to try and get a loan on my for my company, I went to my local bank. And they said, well, can you take out a bigger mortgage on your house? So anyway, the mortgage is a financial loser because the interest rate that's charged is more than you can safely earn by investing, let's say, in government bonds. If you're taking out a 30-year mortgage, it's probably going to cost you 3.5% these days. And if you invest in long-term government bonds, treasury bonds, it's about a 2% return. So there's a differential there. It's also a tax loser because the standard deduction, thanks to the Tax Cut and Jobs Act of 2017, is so high these days that essentially nobody's deducting their mortgage or getting the mortgage deduction. So when you borrow, let's say you borrow money on your house and you invest in long-term treasuries, you're having to pay a higher rate of return on the mortgage and getting a lower rate of return on the investment. So you're losing there, but then the mortgage interest is not deductible, but the mortgage, but the money that you earn on the treasury bond is taxable. So it's a tax loser and a financial loser. I would say pay them off, pay off your mortgage. The best investment going these days is to pay off high interest loans, starting with credit card debt, which is the highest interest, then go to student loans, car loans, mortgages. This is the way, if you say, well, look, this is really crazy, Larry, because I've got money in the stock market and it's earning a terrific return. Well, when you risk adjust that return, as the markets are doing every day by looking at people are buying both stocks and bonds on the market, on the risk adjusted basis, the return on stocks after inflation is negative right now. So it's extremely risky and the risk premium has gotten bigger. The S&P price index, price earnings ratio is about twice its historic average. So the market is extremely risky. The safe thing to do is pay off high interest debts. And even if you need to think about, there's a chapter or a discussion of cashing out your IRA, paying taxes on it, and using the proceeds to pay off your mortgage. I show with a simple example that in some cases that can increase the household's lifetime spending by $100,000.
You know, a lot of what we're discussing right now would be very, very controversial in terms of conventional financial advice. For example, historically, the notion of getting a mortgage and taking advantage of a tax deduction and saying, hey, wait, you know, I'm paying 3.5% on the mortgage, but I'm over the standard deduction. So some of it's deductible and I'm investing it in the market, which historically has returned 8%. I mean, that's the hypothecation argument. So I think that one of the interesting things about the book is the way you lay out a contrary, but interesting and persuasive view. Let me ask you one more thing. The book asks readers to invest like an economist. What does that mean?
Well, traditional advice is that you specify how much you're saving and how much you're going to be spending in retirement, disconnected from what you could afford. If somebody asks me how much I'd like to target to spend in retirement, I'll say $1 billion a day. And then the person will see, and then they simulate using draws on your investment, the probability that you're going to run out of money, which is really the probability that you're starving. And if that probability is low, they say, okay, this is, or they basically gear you, push you into investing with them and saying, well, you'll get a high return. Yes, we're going to have to charge fees, but the probability of your failing is low. And that's really the probability of you're starving to death. So they're setting up a plan and then includes you're starving to death. That's an absolutely crazy thing for you to entertain. Economics says, look, you've got your assets. If you invest, you want to, at risk, you want to understand how your living standard is going to adjust through time, taking into account that every year, if you do well, you'll raise your living, your spending a little bit. If you do poorly, you'll cut your spending. You're not going to just put everything on autopilot, which is what conventional finance says, and figure out whether or not you're going to end up starving or, you know, surviving, but rather you're going to adjust all the time so that you never end up starving, but you're going to see the range of your living standard, the upside and the downside, and you're going to see whether you're comfortable with that. And if you're not comfortable with that, you want to reduce the how aggressively you invest, but also how aggressively you spend, because if you spend too aggressively, that also raises the probability that you're going to be starving when you're older. So there's many, and then the book has some very interesting methodology called upside investing, which I think is perfect for most middle-class people. It allows you to set a living standard floor and only have upside risk relative to that basic living standard. Your living standard can never fall below that upside, that living standard floor. And it's a very simple technique, which is basically not spending out of risky assets. So it lets you be in the stock market, but not jeopardize your basic living standard.
We've been speaking today with Lawrence Kotlikoff. He is a professor of economics at Boston University and has written the book Money Magic, An Economist's Secret to More Money, Less Risk, and a Better Life. Lawrence, thank you for joining us on Mountain Money this morning. You've been listening to KPCW's Mountain Money. Do you love Mountain Money? Let us know. Leave us a review.